Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
It was the voice of our mentor and inspiration, Brian Brown, speaking to us from beyond the grave. So, Brian, we're hoping all is well with you in your new situation. So, with us today, whatever that may be, right? With us today, the briefings are a bit diminished today. Our friend Kevin Jones is not with us, but we have Truman O'Brien and Lynn Kerrigan in the studio and Gail Kellner at her house at Sylvan Beach. And I'm speaking to you from the bluff above KVI Beach. So on a beautiful August morning in Vachon Island. So briefings. Just checking in, anything interesting this week, anything humorous, anything tragic? Yes, Lynn.
Good morning. Well, I'm just back from a week off, which was an interesting experience to go to Eastern Washington up to Holden Village Retreat, where only vaccinated people were allowed in, and anyone unvaccinated, such as children, all had to wear masks. And it was both delightful, you know, to kind of live a little bit more freely and a little bit scary. I don't feel like I was quite ready for that. And, you know, wondering what about all these, you know, asymptomatic people that could have it and they don't know, or breakthrough people, they don't know. But I was so happy to be just not having my own cooking, not having to clean my house, not having to look at my house, and just be able to relax and take classes. I took a metal copper pendant class on how to use copper clay, and I took a class on weaving, and I took a class on abstract art. So it was just like camp for adults, you know, and very sweet, you know, conversations with people I didn't know. So I'm happy to be back, but we were a little bit overwhelmed with the smoke over there from the wildfires that were above us and east of us. So Twisp apparently still has a big fire going, and all that smoke was blanketing Wenatchee so much that you could not see the city.
Really?
Yes. Wow. Scary. And on the way in, they closed I-90 just past Blewett Pass, which I had to go over for either smoke or construction or both. So it was a little bit of a challenge, you know, to do a trip to Eastern Washington at this time. But I came back refreshed, and that's always a good thing. So glad to be back.
Great. How was the smoke at Holden? Holden's up, what, about 5,000-6,000 feet?
Right? I don't know the exact elevation. I suspect lower than that. It's about 10 miles up from Lake Chelan, and yet most of that is switchbacks. I think it's more like 3,000, maybe 2,000 or 3,000. But it was sunny and clear at Holden, which I thought was odd the entire week.
Yeah,
so the smoke is congregating a little bit more to the east of where Holden is. We're still in a little bit in the shadow of the mountains at Holden, and yet, again, coming down from Lake Enneyad and Lake Wenatchee, you know, that's a little bit southeast, was what was so blanketed with terrible, terrible smoke.
Yeah. Well, I was here on Vachon and got out on my e-bike, and I, among other things I saw riding along the roads of Vachon, are giant zucchinis stacked piles along the road. They don't even bother to put a free sign out. It's just clearly obvious. Please take these away if you need, you know, something to, you know, shelter under.
I've always heard that on Vashon, you lock your cars in the spring so people won't put zucchini in them, you know.
Yeah, there was always a funny friend used to say this. He said, people, friends don't give friends zucchini.
Did you see it also made the cartoon sphere that some cartoon, and maybe it was Sunday's paper that I got when I returned, had this gigantic mound of zucchini in somebody's yard, and it was a NASA space person saying, gosh, the Earth is tilting, it's wobbling on its axis, and it has been located in Iowa where somebody has a giant pile in their backyard.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Exactly. I'm sure. So it's zucchini season. Everybody lock your doors.
Must have been a bumper crop.
That's right. Well, I had a wonderful experience. I had my nephew and his wife and his mother, which was my ex-sister-in-law, all came over, and my wife's cousins, and we went to Ober Park and saw the Woody Guthrie show a second time, because I saw it a week ago, and it was so good I had to go back and see it a second time. And we had a big picnic and sat out in the park and had our picnic and watched the play again. And I'm telling you, it was just brilliant. I mean, brilliant.
Our entire group was crying at the end. It was so moving.
It was just perfect. And all of the local voices. My nephew, who's an amazing musician, he's played in rock bands for years and really, really, really good. He was just blown away by the talent. And in particular, our old alumni, Michael Shook. He said, man, Michael just knocked it out of the park, so to speak. Ober Park, that is.
And not only were the singers wonderful, but they brought in a sound engineer named Max Sarkowski from Seattle, who developed the most perfect sound for that show outside that I have ever heard.
It was clear as a bell.
Yes. Every word you heard, and each person had their own little, you know, mic that went to their mouth so they could move around. And I just had never heard such perfect sound.
It was excellent. Mm-hmm. Just excellent. And of course, Kat and Orville and Mark and Steve and the band, just amazing. Just wonderful. Anyway, how about you, Bruce? What's going on with you?
Oh, just normal summer stuff. Crab season's going on, so crab season opened the first week in July and runs to the end of August, and so although it's only open 2 days a week this year, down from 5 days a week last year or 4 days a week last year, and closed the year before that,
right.
So it's really interesting to see how the state is trying to manage the crab resource. But I'm interested, if any of our listeners out there, give me a call about what your crab experience has been, because we're seeing in Tramp Harbor, Klahani Beach, that area sort of around KVI, getting lots and lots of red rock crab, but hardly any Dungeness.
Is that right?
And I think that's one of the problems with Dungeness is their reproductive cycle is heavily influenced by surface water temperature. Surface waters in South Puget Sound have been increasing, you know, not noticeable to us who swim in the sound, but but to Dungeness crab, apparently, it's affecting the reproduction cycle. I have friends up on Camino Island, and they're getting more Dungeness than they ever have. So it's a really interesting sort of way in which global climate change is affecting crabbing in Puget Sound, among lots and lots of other things. Gail, have you had any contact with people crabbing on the west side over where you are?
Yeah, you know, there was quite a bit of crabbing that happened pre-season. I assume that was perhaps local tribes that were crabbing. And we haven't seen a lot of, you know, our crabbing consists of taking a rowboat out and reaching down on low tide, picking them off. And we have only gotten rock crab in that fashion. So we don't... it doesn't seem to be, as like you said, the Dungeness crab don't seem to be there, not in this part of the sound anyway. I think that's some of it, they must have been doing doing pretty well early on because they returned day after day to the point that it actually concerned me that they were overfishing it, that this one little strip here on the North Colos Passage. So maybe it was better here than other places. I don't know. But no longer. They're gone.
Yeah. Bruce, do you drop crab pots yourself? Do you, you know, have... I'm not asking you to share your secret locations, but I'm wondering if that's just something you like to do yourself.
We're going to have to go off the air now.
We three neighbors together share a crab boat called the Crabinator. Named by our teenage neighbors.
That's good.
But yeah, so but we basically set out in Tramp Harbor and Klahani Beach. And, what was interesting this year is the dungeness we did get were huge.
Mm. Oh, really?
We only got a few of them, you know, out of maybe, 40, 50 crab we've gotten so far this year, we've only gotten 5 dungeness. All the rest have been red rock. And so it'll be interesting to see how the state tries to manage that and manage the tribal fishery as well.
Well, you know, I have been reading, though, in Alaska, they've had a tremendous salmon run this year. I know when I used to haul salmon off the beach up at Bristol Bay, that they would close the fishery. You know, they would do a count. And I don't know how they did it, but they would know how many they'd let so much escapement, you know, go up the river, and then they would open it for fishing for a short period of time, and then they close it again for more escapement. So, but this year, evidently, they've had a tremendous run. So
that's great. Yeah.
And that all goes back to the Bolt decision, and you know, which sort of, Native tribes brought suit against the United States government to implement treaty rights in the Medicine Creek Treaty and all the treaties in the Puget Sound region. Was language about sharing the resource in common, which meant equal shares. So tribal fisheries get an equal share to non-tribal fisheries. And what it really did is it forced, the state and the feds and the tribes, the commercial fishermen and the sports fishermen all to sit down and sort of figure out how they were going to manage this resource. So the Bolt decision, sort of vilified at the time by many non-tribal fishery people, really has been the salvation of the fishery in Puget Sound.
When was that decision, Bruce? Wasn't it back in the 70s? Was it that far back?
You know, my recollection is 85, but yeah, it's been a while. Yeah, it was back in the 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
That the decision came down, and it's become the basis for all kinds of federal court decisions regarding Indian fisheries all over the country. So it's become a precedent that's been heavily used to enforce and preserve tribal fishing rights and rights to marine resources all over the country. So.
I remember those protests down in the Puyallup area where my parents moved in the early 70s and through the Puyallup River right there, just lots and lots of people who came to protest and demand an equal share.
Sure. February 12th, 1974.
74 was the Bolt decision.
Correct.
Right.
Yep. Okay. So, Truman just looked it up here.
Yeah, that's the advantage of the internet.
From federal district judge George Bolt.
Bolt.
Yeah.
Who was a conservative Republican. Interesting sort of to see how much the Republican Party has changed since 1974.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of tribal rights, and I'm interested to see what the future may bring when it comes to rights of nature. I think that is a conversation that's beginning to rise, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, what are the rights in this case of the crabs themselves? You know, what are the rights of we sometimes refer to these things as resources, but they're beings, you know, and what are their rights to reproduction, to an environment that's clean and healthy, to being able to carry on their species. So it'll be interesting to see how this rolls out over the next, 20, 30 years.
I think it really will be. There's a strong movement going on in the environmental community around the issue of environmental justice. You know, we've talked about this before in terms of like how redlining affects tree cover in neighborhoods, which affects the ecosystem in urban areas. And so environmental justice has a whole range of dimensions, from impacts on human beings and social structures, all the way to impacts on the individual species within the ecosystem. So I think it's a fascinating sort of emerging concept that goes along strongly with social justice and racial justice and equity, but the concept of environmental justice. So be interesting, as you say, to see how that sort of spins out, particularly as we move into this into this increasing crisis of global climate change.
Okay.
Yeah, Lynn.
I was just going to say, you know, that's such an interesting conversation. You know, it's sounds humorous, you know, when you put it that way, Gail, about, you know, the rights of nature. But on the other hand, you know, we in Western culture just seem to somehow assume that those, quote, resources are just going to be there without understanding impacts from the animal or the tree itself to the ecology and to the roll down, you know, downstream effects on humans and on water and on pollution and air. You know, we just don't see the whole of our system in the universe anymore. And, you know, it has to be called out.
Western culture is not is kind of rather known for this idea of the individual separate from nature, and even in contention with nature, not seeing ourselves as part of a larger whole, which is a more indigenous cultures tend to have that perspective. And I think that we are moving back towards that, and the science is pointing us back that direction as well. When you know, read about the interconnectedness of trees, and when you read about the consciousness of plants, and you begin to understand the full, you know, even Gaia theory, which is the basic idea that the planet itself is a living organism. So,
and a lot of the time it seems that we have justified that by some biblical terminology about dominion over the earth. And yet I have also read that the original word in Hebrew or Aramaic or whatever it came from initially was kind of mistranslated to making this assumption that that meant domination instead of stewardship, and that the original word for that, what our role was in the earth, was stewardship and not domination.
Yeah, and it's interesting in Christian theology, and there's the concept of usufruct, which is this idea of responsible stewardship, if you will. And it tends to get overlooked, even in Christian theology, it tends to get overlooked and tends to be marginalized and pushed to the side rather than being central to the concept of what even Christian theology. And of course, a number of other world religions put nature in a very different place than Christianity does. So it's interesting to see how those discussions will emerge as the global climate change crisis intensifies,
Exactly. Particularly
over the next 4 or 5 years, I think, as we're already seeing some of that intensification. And certainly within 10 years, a lot of those people living at waterfront levels are going to be having to move their houses up to higher up on the beach.
In one village in Alaska, they already are. I mean, it's happening.
Yep.
I was just going to say, in 2018, I attended the Parliament of the World's Religions in Toronto, Canada. And this is a parliament, this is a group of people that have been gathering for over 100 years now. The first gathering was in, I believe, 1893 during the Chicago World's Fair. And it was the first time people from all different religions around the world gathered together and met. they've gathered again 100 years later, and in 1993 in Chicago again, and have been gathering ever since on a periodic basis around the world. And the gathering I attended had over 80 different religions from around the world represented. Mm-hmm. And one of the most significant things that came out of that was what was called, the Fifth Directive. And it's a document called Towards a Global Ethic. And it's this idea that religion has an important role to play in guiding us ethically as a species, and that protection of the earth, that's what the Fifth Directive is about, is that it is all of these people of these religious backgrounds came together in agreement around this issue that we absolutely need to protect and preserve the earth and restore it.
Well, I look forward to developing some better business practices that include, you know, the community and the environment in their planning and development and operations, you know, so that we're not just valuing money, you know, how much money and profit everybody has, but we're looking at a much broader perspective on what is valuable to us. So I appreciate your raising that. That must have been an incredible experience.
Life-changing. Yeah, yes. Really amazing.
Great.
Life-affirming.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were like 10,000 people gathered who cared about justice, peace, you know, equality, you know, cared about the planet. It was really, quite moving.
Great. Well, talking about life-affirming and life-changing. Vashon is gradually reopening. You know, Truman, you talked about going out and listening to a concert outdoors. Lots of things are starting to happen. Dining restaurants are reopening. Lots of events going on the island. Yet, at the same time, we've had a surge of new COVID cases, a number of them breakthrough. You know, we had zero cases between July 14th, between May 25th and July 14th. And since July 14th, we've had 8 new cases of COVID on Vashon. Are we opening too early? Should we be more careful, Truman?
Well, one thing I noticed, you know, when we initially, when everybody went, oh, yay, you know, we're opening up and everything. If you go into Thriftway, maybe a few of the employees are still masked up, but all the customers were unmasked.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. And I was in there this weekend, and I'm thinking 70 to 80% of the customers were masked up again. Uh-huh. So Vashon's taking it seriously in my mind. They are, that's indoor. Now, when we were outside, you know, at Ober Park, and also I went to the Tempest at Open Space, which, by the way, was amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen The Tempest, I don't know, what, 6-8 times, you know, from various productions. And these guys were right up there. I mean, it was fantastic. The venue was amazing because the sprites would all disappear into the woods, you know, and they would run behind trees.
So they literally.
And so they would run behind trees and disappear. I mean, I was knocked out. And the acting was just phenomenal. Sound, I wish they had mic'd up everyone. That would have been. Instead, they had area mics scattered throughout. And so you would hear them. But if they turned wrong or, you know, got a little bit too far away, it was a bit harder to hear. But again, fantastic. And no one was masked up outside.
Well, not a soul was masked up in Eastern Washington. And I'm not talking about, you know, the Holden Village attendees who were all vaccinated. I'm talking about driving in and getting gas and stopping for something quick to grab to eat. I didn't see a soul mask in Eastern Washington. It's a little bit unnerving because I'm willing to mask up to stay safe and be aware of this. I don't know whether it's the asymptomatic, you know, vaccinated people, or it's all the pandemic of the unmasked, you know, as they're talking a lot about. But boy, I would like to help quash this fourth wave.
I think right now I was reading some numbers that 97% of hospitalizations of patients right now are unvaccinated. So it is primarily among people who are choosing not to get a vaccine. And it is rather interesting. I know we talk about reaching herd immunity, but right now we have about, in the United States, have about 85,000 new cases a day.
Gosh.
At that rate, I mean, we're going to reach herd immunity simply by having so many people catch it. I mean, that is, I think, the alternative to vaccination is that people who choose not to will have to go through COVID. And hopefully the healthcare systems will be able to support that decision.
I have to tell you that a few years ago, I had the great, great honor of meeting Dr. Bill Foege. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you folks know of him, but he lived part-time here on the island. And but he is the man who is accredited with squashing smallpox in the world. Mm-hmm. And he has a book called House on Fire that is absolutely brilliant, where he talks about what the way they did it. And, you know, I just read something recently that he said, and he's really skeptical of herd immunity. He said, you know, it didn't work with smallpox, and he's not sure it's going to work here. Mm-hmm. The way they squashed smallpox was to wait until there was an outbreak, and then they would go to where the outbreak was and vaccinate everybody in that area. Well, of course, we have a little bit different situation here, because there in India in particular, they were looking at small villages. So if they had an outbreak in the village, they would go in and just inoculate everyone in the village. With our urban issues that we have here, it's a little bit more difficult. But I think we're talking contact tracing and that sort of thing is what would do this. I mean, if you you get where you have an outbreak, you go in and you inoculate everyone that you've had contact with. And so it's more difficult. And also getting people to do it, you know, that's the other issue. But anyway, I find that interesting that he's questioning the whole herd immunity idea.
Of course, correct me if I'm wrong, Truman, but herd immunity was never an idea that was attempted with smallpox, as far as I'm concerned. It was so devastating that you just had to.
Actually, it was. In India, the whole premise of the book, House on Fire, was that the idea in India was to inoculate as many people as they could throughout the countryside. And so, but they couldn't get everybody, and they couldn't reach, you know, 70-80%. I mean, it was just not possible because it was so widespread. And so they had to fight to get this attack, you know, of the individual outbreaks. They really had to fight the health minister in order to get that. The health minister said, no, we're going to keep, you know, inoculating people around the country. And finally, a young intern, I'm going to just have to tell you the story where the name House on Fire comes from. He came to the guy during this meeting. He said, look, if you're in a village and you have a house catch on fire, what do you do? You concentrate all of the water and resources to put out that fire. You don't just scatter water willy-nilly around the village, hoping that the rest of the village won't catch fire. And so that's what we're trying to do here, mm-hmm. which I thought was a brilliant analogy. But anyway, that's where it all comes from.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting to me. I mean, the most recent outbreak in Sydney, Australia, one person came in from overseas with the Delta variant. And Australia set up really well for contact tracing. Well, they contact traced all the contacts because this person had been in the country 3 or 4 days. They ended up having to isolate 3,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, this Delta variant is very virulent. It spreads like chickenpox. You've probably heard on the news. So it's very virulent. It spreads very easily. And it's sort of like, you know, the house on fire is a good analogy. You've got to put it out where it's occurring, and by isolating, by contact tracing, and by vaccinating. And my fear in the United States is because of the past administration and the way Republicans are approaching vaccinations and the whole pandemic, is it's going to be very difficult in parts of the United States to accomplish that. And so we're going to see massive infection rates and die-offs. And it's already starting to happen. I mean, hospitals in Florida are being pushed to the point where New York was in March and April of last year. Right. They're running out of space. They're running out of intensive care unit beds. You know, it's going to be tragic.
And the patients are much younger, they're saying. That's the other thing that they're noticing.
Yep. Yeah. So we're looking at, at a pandemic that's, as Lynn said, that fourth wave, is coming. And my sense is places like Vashon, places like Washington State, Western Washington, we'll be able to constrain it. Eastern Washington, I'm very skeptical that they'll be able to contain it.
And it's so ridiculous that it's politically motivated. I mean, it just drives me crazy. I keep talking about my friends that on Facebook and all that are, super right-wing folks, and they're just being ridiculous, Oh, the masks don't work, first of all, and then it's the government telling you what to do, to wear a mask, that you can't take away my rights. So, okay, well, you have a right to die, I guess, That's
well, it's
say,
interesting to me about that is that they don't seem to understand that you kind of can't have it both ways.
Well, exactly. Duh.
Want.
It just makes me so angry because it's so stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
know
what's
good.
I was just going to say what's going to happen is very soon we're going to be starting with travel restrictions again and that thing that they're going to be angry about too.
Yeah,
so if you want to be able to continue in an open society, it seems to me a small sacrifice
very
to get
small.
Vaccinated.
Very small.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that I was reading how some insurance companies are going to lift the moratoriums that they had on, moratorium isn't the right word, perhaps. They're going to no longer pay for all of the coronavirus care that people are, are getting. So that people
if
who
they're
are
not vaccinated.
Yeah, if they're not vaccinated.
Correct, yeah.
So it's been, people have tried lotteries and giving away everything from, scholarships to free joints, I heard. Funny things. And we still have a portion of the population that isn't choosing to get vaccinated. And I think it may be come down to finances. Like, okay, if you're going to have to pay out of pocket.
There you go.
But maybe like thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars if you're in the hospital for weeks, you're going to be responsible for that bill. That may, unfortunately, Americans, one thing we're very predictable about is that money moves us. So and I think that maybe just human, not Americans, but Americans in particular, I would say, are sometimes motivated by their pocketbook.
So one of the things that, one of these, it's not a meme, but it's, where there's a like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, they list all of this stuff and everybody just keeps copying and pasting that. The one is saying, well, if you have to cajole people into taking, you have to bribe them with, all of these things, then it must not be a good thing, right? If you have to do all of this stuff, to make people take the shot, then there's got to be something wrong with it. And so what I posted on there was somebody else posted one that says, gosh, all the scientists and the doctors and all the medical staff and everyone says that, we really need to do this vaccine. And those people who barely got out of high school science class are saying that it doesn't matter. Gosh, I wonder who I should listen to. And that's what I posted back on their site. Come on, get a break.
You're just a slave to authority, Truman. That's
I guess.
The problem, right?
Those are just elitist, overeducated liberals telling
that's
you.
That's probably what it is. Oh, my God.
Don't tell me what to do, right?
Exactly. Anyway.
Today is primary election day.
Oh, yeah.
And so have you guys all voted?
No.
No, but I've just had my ballot in my car to drop off at the drop box today. It needs to be in that drop box at the library by 8 p.m. or postmarked today if you want your vote to count.
Yeah. And we only have two things we're voting on?
Yeah, the King County Executive and Proposition 1, I think it is, about the renewal of some child and family services.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It was a short... it was a short ballot, a little disappointing for all the paper that it consumed. I was chuckling when I was going through layers and layers of envelopes and paper, and only to have my, I don't know why I thought this was odd, but to have your signature on the outside of the ballot, like it seems like it should be on the ballot.
No,
separating that. There must be some reason, but for me, it seemed like an odd thing.
Well, so, you don't want to put your signature on the ballot because it's a secret ballot, my dear. If you put your signature on the ballot, it's no longer secret because everybody knows how
you voted. I see what you're saying.
You put it on the outside of the envelope. They just show that you voted, not
that it's you voted for. Because they have a copy of your name
and signature.
And your signature. That's right. And so they can see if it qualifies for a vote right away.
Yeah, it's like a double blind study.
Yeah, sort of.
Exactly.
People counting it know who. Okay.
Or a double evidence study.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it may consume a lot of paper, but I'm very impressed that Washington State probably has one of the best voting systems in the country.
Absolutely.
It's kind of flawless. It's isolated from the internet. It works very smoothly. And it's very easy to register to vote, and it's very easy to vote in Washington State. It doesn't cost postage. You can drop it on a Dropbox. We're really a model for the rest of the country. And that's the kind of thing that why Republicans are shaking in their boots about voter reform, because issues like what's happening in Washington State will doom the Republican Party.
That's exactly right.
Did you read the letter from the, I'm not going to get it now, but it's Maricopa County anyway, in Arizona, that he wrote to the, just basically said, you guys, quit wasting our time and our money. Get it over with. But it was brilliant the way it was written. It's a great letter. It's from.
I want to clarify my complaint about was about the amount of paper. Tiny little things. Not that we were using paper, because I actually think a paper ballot is probably our safest bet in this day and age for being able to accurately count as well as recount as if needed. So I'm a big fan of paper ballots.
Me too. And not be hacked.
I just thought maybe they kind of like Thriftway. Has anyone noticed how Thriftway now, if you go in there and you pick up your receipt, it is printed on both sides. They kind of try to minimize the amount of paper they're going through. I just thought maybe someone could look at the amount of paper on those ballots. That's all.
Here it is. It's the Board of Supervisors. It's from the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, the letter.
To the Arizona Senate, it looks
correct.
Like.
It's correct.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, I think they're going to bring Maricopa County is apparently going to bring suit against the Senate of Arizona for forcing them to go through this recount. And and the outcome, of course, is Maricopa now has had to junk all the voting machines that they've been using because they've been compromised, has to purchase brand new voting machines and voting systems. And so it's going to be very expensive for Maricopa County, and they're suing the state Senate for forcing them to do this because it was unnecessary. So that's going to be a fascinating case to watch as it works its way through the courts. Of course, as we all know, the wheels of justice grind very slowly, but they do grind.
Although, if I can say, speaking of Senate, our state legislature is really doing a great job with some of the union wins. When I came home, that was the first thing I picked up out of the, paper once it was finally re-delivered. If I can segue to Washington State Senate, there were all kinds of bills that are going through our legislature about giving unions a right to deduct fees or not, and removing state employee personal information and requiring employers to provide bargaining representation. I'm trying to read what this is meaning here. Access. There's just a number of worker protections that strengthening the Equal Pay Act. I was so impressed. There are at least 15 different bills going through the legislature right now to strengthen union representatives, and I'm so happy to see labor finally having some greater acknowledgement. You know, we've learned that from COVID. You know, who has really kept the state running are all these essential workers. So I'm grateful to them and grateful we're moving on that.
Well, and what's fascinating about that is most of that influence on the state legislature is coming from public employee unions in the state of Washington, but it's having an impact on even non-unionized labor in the state of Washington. So it's a very interesting process to work. And of course, that's the kind of thing that drives many conservatives crazy. I mean, back in the 1930s, when James Foley was Postmaster General for Franklin D. Roosevelt, and at that time the Postmaster General was generally a political appointee who sort of ran the president's sort of political campaigns, very different than it is today. But he would refer to. At that time, the United States was only 48 states. You know, Hawaii and Alaska had not become states yet. So he would refer to the 47 states of the United States and the Soviet of Washington.
Well, good for us, because to me, it seems like, you know, we have a great economic system. I'm not against capitalism at all, but I think unbridled capitalism without the input of workers and the protection of workers and the decent pay of the people that are making the products or delivering those services, you know, is very imbalanced and foolish in the long run.
Well, that's a concept of why do businesses exist? And what's happened with American capitalism and American corporatism is that, you know, it's become unbalanced, that all of the interest is in the shareholders and maximizing shareholder profit rather than in maximizing the benefit of the corporation to employees and to shareholders. And so it's a really interesting sort of way that American business has, and particularly in the last 30, 40 years, has unbalanced that sort of concern that back in the 1940s and 50s, out of the New Deal was a much more balanced concern.
Right. Yeah, that came out of the Reagan years when there was a policy passed to not consider so much the rights of the consumer or the stakeholders, but the shareholders only. And it really has led to that imbalance. So thanks for bringing that up.
It really has. So in the last few minutes here, we just got a minute or two. Any thoughts on the infrastructure bill that's working its way through D.C. and looks like it's going to pass both the Senate and the House? Yeah, Gail.
Well, you know, it was interesting because it's such a big bill, $3.5 trillion. That is a huge amount of money, obviously. And so I was happy to see some of the things that were included in it for the environment. And a little surprise, you know, among them, you know, things like giving money to capturing carbon emissions from, you know, industry. I think that was great. I thought it was great that some of that money is going to be for developing an electric charging stations across the country. But I thought those numbers seemed pretty small in a bill that big. There was only about $7.5 billion for developing this electric charging station, which is a key piece of getting us to a clean economy and a clean system.
And it sounds like we're hung up a little bit on how to pay for it. And they're starting to really specify where they're going to find the money to do that $1 trillion, up to $3 trillion. So we'll be following that really closely.
One of the things that I heard last night that I find pretty interesting is that they're saying that for a change, the senators themselves appear to be happy. And they haven't really been, quote, happy for like the last 4 years, that they're more congenial. Just on a personal level. Mm. And it's because of the fact that they're actually working together and doing something, which is,
I think, that's probably really true. And one thing they did put a lot of money into is $73 billion into modernizing the electric grid, which is something we've talked about, you know, the need for that, regardless of where the electricity originates from, your grid has to be modernized in order to efficiently deal with the coming climate change and the climate change.